I was in Tower 1 in the elevator traveling up to the lobby level when American Airlines Flight 11 struck it.
I'm still healing. I don't know if I'll ever be back to what they consider the normal.
I've never been claustrophobic. All I knew is I closed the door, I started sweating, my heart started racing. I'm like, what in the world is going on? One morning I woke up, looked at myself in the mirror and did not recognize my own reflection staring back at me. And that was the scariest moment of my life.
We've given ourselves to service, and this is what happens. And enjoy it, embrace it, and find a way to heal from it.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. This is a special 9/11 episode, and along with my co-hosts, Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMT, and Dr. Stacy Raymond, I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Samantha Horwitz, who was a 9/11 first responder, a former United States Secret Service agent, speaker and author, and John Salerno. He's also a 9/11 first responder. He's a retired NYPD detective and a firefighter turned comedian. And both Sam and John are hosts of a Badge of Honor podcast. We'll be diving into their roles as responders at 9/11, post-traumatic stress, post-traumatic growth, wellness, and resiliency. We'll also be bringing you a new installment of Resilience Toolbox, spotlighting a tribute to the 343 New York firefighters who died in the 9/11 attacks. Building Homes for Heroes is gifting its 343rd mortgage-free home to retired Army Specialist Evan Marcy, a Purple Heart recipient and son of a New York firefighter. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, all the podcast platforms, bbsradio.com, and check out our website, respondertv.com.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB. In this installment of Resilience Toolbox, we're speaking with Andy Pujol, founder and CEO of Building Homes for Heroes, and Dwayne Marcy, an FDNY firefighter who served at Ground Zero. Dwayne is the father of retired Army Specialist Evan Marcy. We'll be spotlighting Building Homes for Heroes, an organization which builds and gifts mortgage-free homes and completes home modifications for veterans, emergency first responders, and their families. In a tribute to the 343 New York firefighters who died in the 9/11 attacks, Building Homes for Heroes is gifting its 343rd mortgage-free home to Evan Marcy, who's a Purple Heart recipient. Andy, we'll start with you. What's your connection to the terrorist attacks of 9/11?
Everyone all around the country, no matter rural an area you lived in, each and every one of us holds 9/11/2001 close to our hearts. It was a shock to all of us. I think, a lot of us had PTSD for many weeks and months and maybe years to come. I know I did. I was so shocked, so devastated. I knew I had to do something. The first thing I did was take my children out of school. Then mission number two was to load my truck up with supplies to the best I could, because I knew that this was gonna be long haul. Made my way to the Midtown Tunnel. I'll never forget it. It was the scariest experience of my life to see military at the Midtown Tunnel for the first time. The city was already black. Kind of kept making my way down, and finally I got to Port Authority Police Headquarters. Unloaded the truck with them, gave them everything I had, and the guy looked at me and said, is there anything I could do for you? I said, yeah, you can gear me up. So they geared me up and pointed me in the right direction and made my way in. And I'll never forget that moment, turning the last corner and witnessing 9/11 for the first time. I didn't waste any time. I jumped right into the bucket brigade, did everything I could to help out. And I sat down one moment on the rubble to rest, and I actually started to cry. And I looked around at the fires burning all around me. People forget the fires burned for 100 days. And there were so many fires, so much smoke, so much ash. You knew it wasn't healthy. There was nothing about it healthy. And I kept looking at all the firefighters, all the police officers and EMS workers. And I went, my God, these are my heroes. These are heroes. These are true American heroes. And they still are my heroes.
Dwayne, what was your role in the search and rescue efforts at Ground Zero after 9/11?
Well, I was working on 9/11. So I was working up an 80 engine up in Harlem and the night before. So I was working the night into the day. And typically within the fire department, when there's a multiple alarm over the intercom systems that are all tied in together, it was announced that there was a multiple alarm going on in lower Manhattan. So with that, we all start tuning in and trying to find out what was going on. And then as we saw the first tower come down, I knew at that point, I had said it in the TV room, that we just lost hundreds of guys. The way it worked back in the day was when you were in a busy area, if you weren't assigned to a box that you knew there was a good job going on, you would call the dispatcher. And a lot of times the dispatchers were friends of yours because they would show up at different events. So you got to know them a little bit personally. And you would always ask for them and then ask them to put you assigned to that box, that the multiple fires going on, because it was really kind of, say, out of your area. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I was doing that day, is calling dispatches. And had they approved my request, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today, because they kept telling us, no, stand fast, stay in your area. We'll let you know when we need you. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, they sent us down there. At this point, you know, both towers were down. And then we stayed there for another 24 hours on duty. We relieved the companies that were there, took over another line, and we're just trying to put these fires out. You know, so we stayed there for that whole night into the morning, saw the sunrise. And then, we got there with all the smoke and everything. You really didn't get a good feel of what was going on. But then the next day, once, it was lighter and you could see what was going on, the devastation, it was surreal. You know, I felt like I was on a movie set of some kind of sci-fi fiction movie, you know, but we were living it, you know, we were there. And then it was just every day, whether you were working on the chart or off the chart, we were there. And if you weren't there, you were going to a funeral.
Andy, tell us about Building Homes for Heroes. What does it do and who do you assist?
Building Homes for Heroes came from the promise of, sitting on the rubble that one night and saying a prayer and asking God for guidance, and I made a promise that we'll never forget, and we do it still to this day with humility and honor. And the last 4 or 5 years, we've averaged almost 40 homes, one home every 11 days to one home every 8 days.
Well, Dwayne, let's talk about your son, retired Army Specialist Evan Marcy. He sustained injuries during his deployment in Afghanistan in 2006. Can you give us a snapshot of what happened and what Evan's road to recovery was like?
Well, we received a phone call from his commanding officer. We didn't know Evan was going to make it. And the phone call basically was to see if we had passports and get us prepared to fly to Germany to say goodbye, because his injuries were so severe. They said they amputated the one leg. They weren't sure if he was going to survive another operation, and they were on the fence of amputating his other leg. So his injuries were quite severe. It was a 5-hour firefight, from what we were told, where they couldn't get backups in there. The Apache helicopters could give them air support, but they couldn't land, so they couldn't give additional soldiers. 3 days after we got that phone call, or actually it was probably 2 days, we were at Walter Reed And we were going to welcome him and all the other wounded soldiers in, because that's how quick. This was after like three or four surgeries. He was basically unconscious when they brought him in. So we got to see him just a couple of days later. And then being in Walter Reed, seeing all these, you know, wounded vets was just overwhelming. It was just so heartbreaking.
To both of you, I'll say that you've taken extremely adverse circumstances and created something really positive out of it. So let's talk about that. Can you tell us a little bit about the special significance of this home that Building Homes for Heroes is gifting to Evan?
Just the satisfaction and joy to know that Evan's going to have a secure place to live. You know, I want the best for my children. And with Evan, he's been not in one place, you know, for a very long period of time. He's down in New Orleans. He was in New York for a while. And just to be able to gift him this home, it's just the feelings are overwhelming. But also what Andy did was when he made the announcement, he made an announcement in a firehouse that I was working at as a fireman. And Evan used to run around and, you know, climb on those rigs. He spent Christmas there, you know. So he had spent over, you know, days there at the firehouse as a kid. And then for him to get this presentation there at the firehouse it was mind blowing. And it was, you know, very unique, very humbling.
Yeah, Andy, what's your perspective on the special significance of this particular home?
You know, again, from sitting on the rubble of 9/11 for 10 minutes and, like I said, with tears in my eyes and prayers, and, you know, just looking at the firefighters all around me, the heroes all around me, working so hard. I mean, I was just in awe. And to say that prayer and that promise, and then 22 years later, that we'll reach our 343rd home. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a miracle. I mean, how did this happen? I've never taken a single penny. It's been out of honor. And, you know, our charity was rated 93% for the last 12 consecutive years. I'm told less than 3% of all charities in the country receive that honor. So we're doing everything we can right. And we're doing it all in the spirit of those same firefighters and first responders who worked their hearts out, and many of them who gave their lives, who died of cancer.
Let's touch on the home itself. Can you tell us a little bit about this mortgage-free customized home that's in Connecticut that Evan's going to be receiving?
First of all, we build homes from the ground up, and we receive homes from Chase Bank, believe it or not. And they've been a tremendous partner. Chase Bank, Lowe's, Advance Auto Parts, they donated this home to us, and most of the homes they donate to us are in disarray and need a lot of work. And this home was in very good shape in a very good neighborhood on a cul-de-sac. And I went, oh, this home is beautiful. I mean, it has potential to be beautiful, you know. And we tore up the driveway, we tore up the sidewalks, we tore up a couple of rooms, we expanded some things. This is going to be just beautiful when it's done. And we're still working day and night right now. And we will be right up until Saturday morning.
Well, in closing, Dwayne, anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to speak about?
A heartfelt, you know, warm thank you to Andy and his organization for being able, you know, to make this opportunity available to Evan and to also, you know, to all these vets. I mean, you know, you just think about a 343rd home mortgage-free to, you know, a veteran that's been out there on the front lines protecting us, you know, while we're still here. You know, we fought a battle, but it was, like Andy said, it was 22 years ago. You know, they're still out there on the front lines, and to have an organization like this that's still looking after them, you know, means a lot. You know, from what you see in the news and all the garbage that's on the air all the time, you know, this is great. You know, and it's a beautiful organization, a beautiful thing that they're doing.
Andy, this is an uplifting, inspiring success story where you took a circumstance of adversity and seeing the challenges that we face as Americans and as New Yorkers. You put something beautiful together that's still paying it forward. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Yeah, and thank you. And I think you segued into that perfectly, David. You know, because, you know, as Americans, we have this ability to look at the worst things, the most difficult things, and we rally together. You know, we found a way to turn something unimaginably horrific into something that is now, today, very beautiful. And, you know, only in America we can do that. But, you know, I want to thank everyone that's involved. And I also want to let you know that everyone know that we're now helping first responders, not only with homes, but with physical wellness and mental well-being and other areas. And we hope to help thousands in 2024. So a lot more to come, more announcements. And David, I want to thank you for this opportunity, this privilege. God bless you.
It's my honor to speak with both of you. Andy, one last question, and that's, how can people get in touch or find Building Homes for Heroes?
Well, go to our website, buildinghomesforheroes.org, not Homes for Heroes. That's a real estate discount company, so don't send your money there. Don't contact them. buildinghomesforheroes.org, and please reach out to us. We will welcome you with open arms, and every donor is important to us, and we treat you that way. Please join us and enjoy what we're building together.
Andy Pujol and Dwayne Marcy, thank you for joining us today in Resilience Toolbox and sharing this incredible story. Continued success to both of you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Here's our special 9/11 interview with Samantha Horwitz and John Salerno of A Badge of Honor. And in this episode, we're joined by Sam Horwitz and John Salerno. They're the hosts of A Badge of Honor podcast. I've had the pleasure of being their guest on that podcast. Samantha is a 9/11 first responder. She's also a former U.S. Secret Service agent, a speaker and author, and she's become an expert in handling stress and managing PTS. John Salerno is also a 9/11 first responder, retired NYPD detective, and a firefighter turned comedian. And since his diagnosis of PTSD, he decided not to allow his condition to stop him from making a difference in others' lives. So John's dedicated to bringing awareness to the suicide epidemic plaguing our first responder community through his work at A Badge of Honor. And just a word about A Badge of Honor. It's a nonprofit that provides PTS awareness and suicide prevention for first responders and veterans. Sam and John, a warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Yep.
That was one hell of an open, I got to tell you that right now.
Now you have to follow up on the delivery of all that.
Wow.
So, Sam, I'd like to start by asking you a question. Each of us knows exactly where we were on September 11th, 2001. Most people only saw what happened on the news. Where were you when American Airlines Flight 11 hit the tower?
Yeah, Doc Stacey, I was in Tower 1 in the elevator traveling up to the lobby level when American Airlines Flight 11 struck it. Normal course of the day, going to work and take the elevator to the lobby level, go up an escalator, go across the plaza level, which is outside and into my building, Building 7, but didn't quite go as planned that day. Had no idea that a plane had struck the building. But there certainly was a debris field all the way in the lobby level where the elevator car stopped.
Wow. So, John, I'd love to hear your perspective on what you were doing at that same time frame. Were you on duty or off duty? And how did you get involved with becoming a 9/11 responder?
I had just retired from the NYPD on a medical injury. But for the last 24 years prior, I've been a volunteer fire department on Long Island, because Long Island has nothing but volunteer firefighters. I was the first assistant chief of my firehouse. And I remember putting on socks, getting ready to, I don't remember what I was going to do that day. I was just getting ready for something. I was putting on a sock and I saw the first plane hit and I was like, oh my God. Knowing that we're on a mutual aid to the FDNY, I geared, I got dressed fast. I started heading to the firehouse. I get to the firehouse. I meet a couple other firemen out of there, and they're like, see what happened. That's when a second plane hit. Now, in our firehouse, we had many FDNY members who were on duty that day. Chief Gansey, the chief of the FDNY at the time, was a member of our firehouse. He's a volunteer in our firehouse. Huh. So we were wondering what are we doing? So we start gearing up, we start prepping, start loading the trucks and getting ready to go. So at that point, as we're making all our preparations, the towers come down. I had a rescue truck and a fire truck behind me. So we staged at Shea Stadium for about an hour. We move up to a firehouse in Queens where our engine is deployed to backfill some of the firehouses within Queens. Our rescue unit and myself went right to ground zero. Mm-hmm. We pull up on Vesey, and we pull up on Vesey and Broadway right in front of 10 truck, and we start, you know, it was total chaos. And like Sam says, it was no radios, comms were down. Mm-hmm. So it was actually a free-for-all. Nobody really knew what to do. All of Central Command, the two command posts that were set up, were wiped out. We were getting word that many of our friends were missing, and that Pete Yancey was one of the missing. Mm-hmm. So everybody was actually freelancing at that very moment, at that beginning moment, until things started getting coordinated. Everybody was just freelancing and doing whatever they could. You know, getting into the getting into the debris, crawling into holes, looking for survivors, putting out spot fires with whatever water we had available, and just doing what we could do. So it was a chaotic scene until actually the next day, till things started, you know, everybody getting a perspective on what the hell just happened.
So Sam, can you comment on, you know, how did you get out of the building, and then, you know, how is this all affecting you now? How were you affected by such a tragedy?
Well, by the time I made it to my building, which is again building 7, Tower 2 hadn't been struck yet. So myself, a supervisor, and some of my squad mates were in the lobby. We were talking. The Tower 2 gets hit, and we're thinking that it's a coordinated bombing attack, that we're the third tallest building in the World Trade Center complex, and we're next. Again, we had no idea it was planes. So naturally, we're thinking, well, we're going to go back up to our desks and start investigating what happened. We soon realized maybe this wasn't, you know, safe to stay in our building. So we got out through basically where we brought folks, where we got arrested. The public got a lovely view of where we walked them down the hallways into our holding rooms and everything before we were able to get them over to more secure facilities. But we took people through there, ended up on West Side Highway, where we kind of took in what had occurred. You could see huge gaping hole in Tower 1. Tower 2 was clearly on fire behind it. Again, no idea it was planes. Mm-hmm. And we were standing there, and an agent that was driving, driving towards the scene, which would be driving south, he sees us on the side of the road, slams on his brakes, and just says, "Oh my God, you guys see the planes?" And we're like, "Plane? What are you talking about? The planes that hit the towers." And we're like, you know, your brain's trying to figure, the planes don't hit these. These are the two largest towers, you know, in New York. They all have warning systems, even for helicopters. And there's landing, the helicopter helipads all over. Like, you don't miss the buildings. And as we're talking to him, he's got his regular car radio on, not the police scanner radio, the police radio rather. And we hear that the Pentagon gets hit. So we're like, are we at war? What is going on? This is big time now. And what do we do? Well, he swings his car around, gets out of the city. We're left standing on the side of the road, again, trying to wrap our heads around what is occurring in front of us. and we end up, Tower 2 comes down, we end up running into a school, which were the closest open doors to us. And as you can imagine, you know, some of us are armed, some of us are wearing t-shirts because you're in the gym. I had a suit on. So the school staff were like, "Who are you people?" And we identified ourselves, told them what was going on. The principal went to make the phone calls he needed to make. And we asked, "Hey, you know, this is what's going on. Can we use your school as triage? We're going to go, some of us are going to go leave the school building and go pull people out." And you couldn't be outside without having your mouth and nose covered because of that dust. And so the guys were ripping up their shirts, fashioning bandanas. Myself and two other agents stayed behind to set up this triage area. And the idea was, okay, guys, go start pulling people out, bring them to us. We'll triage them, get the ambulances, get them on the ambulances, and they'll do their job. Well, that never happened. About 30 minutes later, the principal comes and finds us. "Hey, we've been given orders to evacuate." Like, "All right, we'll help you. We can do this." And we didn't know that the school we ran into, were they were all, the student body was mentally and physically handicapped kids. So you've got walkers, you've got wheelchairs, you've got crutches. And these kids, I mean, they knew how to evac. They had it down. They knew to be in their lines. A lot of them were helpful. Some of them were clearly scared. They had no idea who we were. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Not friend. And so we're just trying to encourage them to get out with speed, because the one thing, and I know John, you know, he's talked about all the noises and everything, that when you are outside around grounds, what was by the end of the day termed Ground Zero, there were a lot of noises. And for me, it was a low grumbling, growling sound that I heard right before Tower 2 came down. And we're outside, we're with the student, last one's out of the building. It's me, the agents I was with, the student's aide, student, and the principal, last one's out. We're walking, trying to get to West Side Highway. And the student's like, we scared him. We didn't mean to, but he was visibly shaken, frightened, and he stopped walking. And we're trying everything in our power to get him to walk, to convince him that he needs to, you know, stay with his classmates. He's not having any of it. And all of a sudden, start hearing that low grumbling, growling sound. Well, I look at the two agents that were with me. We exchange glances and we're like, "We got to go now." And we scoop this young man up and we start running up West Side Highway as Tower 1 is coming down. And that dust cloud that every documentary has made famous is rolling up West Side Highway right to us. And we beat it. Felt like every single muscle was on fire. But we beat that dust cloud, got the young man and his aide onto an ambulance that seemed to appear out of nowhere. The entire time, my brain is taking pictures, right, and storing them. That's how the brain works. And so I got back to my apartment, thanks to the New Jersey field office agents who all brought their personal vehicles and their G-rides to the New Jersey side of the Hudson. We got ferried across the Hudson River by U.S. Park Police. So 5:30 p.m., I'm back in New Jersey in my quiet apartment, and it's like, now what? And as the evening wore on, you know, I had never heard of the symptoms that go along with post-traumatic stress. Just like, if you see something bad, you know, stuff can happen. And I started experiencing it pretty much a couple hours later, with that anxiety issue, being in an enclosed space, which was my bathroom. Mm-hmm. I've never been claustrophobic. All I knew is I closed the door, I started sweating, my heart started racing. I'm like, what in the world is going on? Mm-hmm. And so here I am Secret Service agent trained at the highest levels of law enforcement, and I can't even get in my own bathroom to take a shower. Pretty strange.
One of our colleagues committed suicide, and I was the first one on the scene and walking through the door of the hotel room.
Was a motor vehicle accident, people trapped, people on fire, human running down the street on fire.
I witnessed a patient who was assaulted with a baseball bat. And I remember opening the front door and hearing a police officer screaming, "It's bad."
And how long was it, Sam, until you decided to get help for your traumatic symptoms?
Oh my gosh, not for a couple of years. Big mistake. Big mistake. When you go through a trauma, you got to start talking immediately. You know, now we have the critical incident stress management. We've got critical debriefs. We did have a debrief, one debrief at an airport two days later. So as you can imagine, every sound that went on in an airport was, you know, got our attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, you know, we carry these images, like Sam was talking about, your mind taking pictures. And I think it's probably more sensory than that, right? We may be taking in the smells, the sounds, the sights, the sensations. How's that played out in your life in terms of what you witnessed and experienced at 9/11, and then fast forward into your life? How did that resurface? Like, was there times when it really became untenable for you to handle those memories?
You know, I'm on the other side of the spectrum, so to speak, because I was traumatized as a child. I was sexually assaulted for 2 years, so my coping mechanisms were skewed as a child. So I don't remember 9/11 to the point where I don't remember being physically on the mound digging and doing these things. I get bits and pieces every once in a while, but my memory, because of what happened as a child, is blocked. So I didn't actually know I was in such a deep trauma state most of my life because of what happened. And so my coping skills were anger, were drinking, and I thought that was all part of the normal life. So I didn't really know. And then, you know, fast forward after 9/11, I noticed my anger and my rage was getting worse. I didn't know how to attribute it to anything. We really didn't have back then the mental health awareness programs that we have today. Nobody really knew about, you know, we hit it. We were, you know, back then we all hit it. And so when we moved to Texas, you know, I truly believe paths cross for a reason, you know, and for however things started, I started doing stuff with, and my kids just bought me, for my 40th birthday, they were like, "Listen, we're going to send you to comedy classes." You know, I'm like, I never thought I was going to be a comic, but I felt that was a way of expressing myself and healing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually verbally talking about stuff on stage with and making people laugh. And that was a healing aspect. So what that turned into was me starting a radio show called Making a Difference, because I felt every time I made someone laugh, I would feel good, and it would bring me into a different part of my life. So I started saying, all right, let me start helping organizations. Let me start doing this, making a difference stuff. Let me, Let me make people feel good. So it started taking off. And me and Sam crossed paths. Somebody turned around and a person I met at a different event said, hey, I know somebody from a 9/11 responder who would be great for your show. Bring her on. And, you know, the rest is history. And we're blessed that our connections met, because we're on two different sides of DFW. We would have never met. So I really believe, you know, whatever God you believe in or whatever faith you believe in brought this together for both of us to heal in a certain way.
So, Sam, what was your healing journey like?
Long, long and painful. People that are going to listen to this, you know, we know better now in law as first responders, right? So we know not to stuff things down, but back then it's not what we did. We had a job to do. And again, with the Secret Service, there were so many things going on post 9/11 with, you know, President Bush coming to the city and different just things going on because the UN was there. A lot of stuff was put on hold, but your job's never really put on hold. We were, some of us were assigned to fresh kills to sift through evidence, others directly at ground zero. You did what you could do to help out because everybody pulled together. The city pulled together, the nation pulled together. And so I think part of that support that we had from the community made it easier to deal with. Now, behind closed doors in private, I was a disaster. I the days, the weeks, and months that went on, I had a major startle reflex. So any really loud noises took me right back to 9/11. And, you know, I felt unsafe. That hypervigilance at all times, even in my own apartment building. So I when I would get the mail, I would be armed. I felt like I had to be armed in my mail. Everything was behind locked doors. So it's not like somebody was going to, you know, come in on me. And it was the ultimate system being hijacked to where it was like, Sam, exercise control at all costs. And that control, whoosh, with everything. And if the more I felt I needed control, it meant the more things that I couldn't control, I had to push to the side. Now, my job is very, very demanding, as people can imagine, being a Secret Service agent. And I will never forget sitting at my desk reading the same paragraph of a report that I had to hand in. Reading comprehension was never an issue for me. Writing was never an issue for me. I went to law school, so I drafted briefs and did all this. I couldn't comprehend anything. Mm-hmm. Everything was just sideways, and I thought I was going insane. Nobody was talking about the 2-ton elephant in the room. Everybody waited till 5 o'clock, and if you were not on a protection assignment or you did not have to be in court bar time, you know, or you were taking your government vehicle home and, you know, parking it and then finding a local watering hole or going to the grocery store, just whatever you needed to do to get through. And it was, I just wasn't me anymore. And I knew that the inability to operate at 100% meant somebody might not go home. And I made the very difficult decision to resign my position as an agent, something that I worked really, really hard for. I mean, I left blood on the mat in training for. I thought it was going to be my career. And like anything, you know, your plan is your plan. His plan is his plan. And my plan took a sharp detour, and I thought that moving out of state, I was married. We were living in two different states, moving in with my husband, finally into a house that we could call ours together, was a phenomenal solution. And, you know, I smile and I laugh because it's like, duh, your head's connected to your body, Sam. I mean, come on. Everything you smelled, you saw, it's not going anywhere. And things just got a lot worse where I made my home my prison. I couldn't risk being outside. My entire identity, everybody knew me as Sam, the Secret Service agent. Well, Secret Service agents don't dive for cover when a dumpster truck does what dumpster trucks do, right? You don't cower away from a window when there's a huge clap of thunder. It's Mother Nature, you know, a thunderstorm. The littlest day-to-day things, my system, I could not deal with it. And like I said, if I couldn't have control, I just kept pushing things away. And I pushed my family away. But what I didn't know was kind of in the background, they were watching this downfall. And one morning I woke up, looked at myself in the mirror and did not recognize my own reflection staring back at me. And that was the scariest moment of my life. And it was that evening, happened to be New Year's, and I was like, I'm not living another year like I just lived this past one. And I was convinced that nobody needed me in the state I was in. And so after said goodnight to friends who had come over for New Year's Eve and tried to get some sleep, came downstairs, grabbed the remaining bottles of alcohol. That was my thing. I use alcohol to numb out. I just didn't want to feel anything. If I didn't feel, life was good. Well, life was sucking beyond at this point. And so I was like, all right, this is it, man. So I went down to my basement and tried to kill myself with my gun. And my dog ended up interrupting my suicide attempt and played a very dangerous game for a year. Check in or stay present or check out. And it was between how my dog interrupted my attempt, being spoken to by the big guy upstairs. And I know this podcast isn't about faith, but stuff happens for a reason that's just not, it's inexplainable. Did I just make up a word? it did. He spoke to me and he sent my dog, and there's no denying that. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, if you're not going to give me any answers right now, maybe I need to just stay in the game a little bit longer. And my mom ended up coming over unannounced one day, put a piece of paper in my hand that had a name and a number on it. And it was to a very skilled therapist who did an EMDR, was the therapy. And it saved my life. And I'm sitting here with you today.
Able to talk about it. Well,
yes, yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're grateful for that intervention. And it just shows you there is a plan, right? And we can take pain and trauma and help so many people with it, which is what you're doing now.
And the plan to, you know, meet John, because if I took myself out, we never would have met. We never would have shared our stories. And, you know, we've gone deep and we've been both, even all these years later, you know, there's still stuff. It's not cured. You live with it. But the skills that you learn to manage it, I'm not disordered. That you can take that D and push my extra disorder. You can take that D and throw it out the window. And John will agree with me as well. And this is what we teach, what we educate on, that, you know, the stress and the trauma are going to be there, but ultimately it's your choice. We'll help you get the help if you need it, because not everybody's different, right? EMDR, John. His treatment has been different. If Jeff was here, he's done EMDR and some other different things, but we got equine therapy, being in nature. I mean, important things that to focus on. And it's now in the work to let people know, hey, you're not broken. You're not disordered. And if somebody tells you you are, you run. Run away very quickly. And that there's help. There's vetted help. There's competent, culturally competent help for you out there. And whether it's, you know, reaching out to you guys, whether it's reaching out to us, reach out. We're there to offer a hand up and help, and we'll get you connected. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do now. And that's what it's all about. It's using what we've been through to grow and now to give back.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
Sam, I want to thank you very much for your vulnerability and for sharing such a deep, private, personal business of your life in order to help others. It's admirable. And I would say once an agent, always an agent. And this is just your way of being the agent now.
Well, thank you for that. And you're very welcome. It's my pleasure. You know, God and I had a pretty difficult relationship. You know, when you have 3,000 people die, and then the cancers and everything after that, it's like, what then? You know, it's the why that never really gets answered. And for me, straying the way I did, him showing me, hey, there's always a plan. You got, it's that giving control over. Because the control is, especially as a first responder, is we yeah. never want to give right. up that control. And the lesson from mine is, hey, you know, the seat at the table was always there. I was the one that got up and walked away.
Right.
And my chair was just empty. And he just was like, hey, when you're ready, it's there. And I had to, quiet this. And to really be able to understand that. And my body went through some really crazy physical stuff until EMDR kind of brought me back to baseline, where I was operating feeling like I had an electric wave that just was pulsing through my body all the time, unless I was drinking or in EMDR. It was very strange.
You know, Stacy and I do EMDR with folks, but all three of us have had experience with it. And in order to be a therapist of it, you have to go through it yourself. And it's always incredible in those moments where it is truly body-based, you know, pain, sensations. It's incredible to watch it ping pong around, which is partially what you're describing. But then for people to get to the place where they're releasing it and they feel it dissipating or they feel it leave, it's fascinating for us to watch, because every person is different and we're different when we go through it as well.
So John, Sam talked about her low point. Can you share with us a little bit about a low point you might have had following 9/11 and some of the other factors going on in your life? How did you cope with that? And then how did you kind of get to where you are today?
I'm still healing. I don't know if I'll ever be back to what they consider the normal. It's a challenge each and every day. Have my low points every day, and I have my high points. So I still battle triggers. There are a lot of things that that affect me, and I'm still working through them. And this is 22 years later. You know, I don't know if Sam brought you. We did a 9/11 event like 3 years ago, and they imploded a garage across the street where we were doing this 9/11 event, and just the dust triggered me. Mm-hmm. So I'm still learning. I'm still trying to find out what all my triggers are, because between sight, sound, touch, everything, it's a multitude of lifelong trauma as a child, through firefighting, through police department. So if I could say anything to anybody, any first responders out there, do not get frustrated that you are not 100%, because we've given ourselves to service, and this is what happens, and enjoy it, embrace it, and find a way to heal from it. And we do that with a badge of honor, and I feel that as we bring healing to other people, we heal a little bit inside as well, you know. So that's pretty much, you know, my ups and downs, if that answered the question correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great answer. Thank you.
Can you talk about a badge of honor, how it got started, and what your mission is currently at this time?
Well, with Badge of Honor, me and Sam collaborated together, and we felt we needed to start healing other first responders, because we recognized what happened to us, and we didn't want that to happen to anybody else. So we started our radio show, and we started to build, and we started to talk, and we found out more and more how important it is to get the word out, even if it's to one person at a time. So now we just keep growing. And that's our fight together. We want to bring the word out. We want to make sure that we don't lose anybody. We don't want, you know, every time we hear of a first responder suicide, we investigate it, we find out the whys, and we try to fix those. We try to see if we can help in any way to maybe change the process or the protocols or do something to save that next life, you know?
And John and I realized that it needed to go beyond us, you know, just telling our stories. And so through speaking engagements, you know, John's met a lot of people, and I met a lot of people, and we ended up bringing on two additional partners. Jeff is a current police officer, and John is an amazing, John Edmonds, an amazing practitioner who practices EMDR and beyond. At Healing Springs Ranch up in Tioga, Texas. And so we've got four people that come from, you know, our childhoods were all very different. We all have different things that happen. And then we all have the traumas on top of that. And so we're able to come together and realize, well, my goodness, we can reach a lot of people, whether they connect with John's story directly, or Jeff's story, or whomever. Take a piece of us, take a piece of our story. But the biggest thing is, like what John just said, is take it, run with it, and heal with it. And whether that's traditional therapy or non-traditional therapy, we made it a point to partner with a whole bunch of organizations and practitioners that are culturally competent. And so we're also in the state of Texas, there's something called TCOL. It's just the first responders, their continuing education credits. So we're TCOL certified. We go into the departments. So the departments host us. The first responders get their training credits. And John said it best, we get to heal while healing.
You know, Dave, if I could just interrupt real quick, and just to bounce off what Sam says, it's all about transparency. Mm-hmm. You know, we are 100% transparent on every aspect of our lives. And we did two separate workshops. And in my workshop, now that I'm able to bring this out about the sexual assault when I was young, I brought that out at two workshops, and two separate people came up to me and said, that happened to me when I was younger. So it really goes to show that you're not alone in every aspect of your life. In every trauma that happens, there is somebody else out there that has experienced something similar. Mm-hmm. So never think that you are the only one that is battling this same issue. We share our experiences, and one or two people per workshop will come up and say, I'm feeling that same thing. I'm going through that same battle. How do you do it? And, you know, that's where the healing starts. Mm-hmm. If we just internalize everything, then we don't, then everybody feels alone. Mm-hmm. If we let it out, people go, you know what? I'm feeling the same way. Mm-hmm. And that's what we all have to do. We have to cry together. We have to hug together. We have to love together. We have to bring it all together and not keep this armor on us that right. suffocates all our trauma. We rip it off and show and expose who we are.
Well said, John. I just want to ask you, so people can find you, where are you, what's your website, social media links, anything like that? Where can people find the podcast?
Sam?
Oh, well, we are a badgeofhonor.org, and we have a link on there for the podcast. We're across all social media. Our podcast is live every Monday, 5 p.m. Central. And it's as easy as going onto YouTube if you like to spend time there and putting in a Badge of Honor podcast. We also broadcast live on Twitter as well as LinkedIn Live. And on Twitter, we are a Badge of Honor 1. So that's the only difference. But we're across everywhere. We're on Getter. We're on MeWe. Just look up a Badge of Honor or go to our website, abadgeofhonor.org.
All right. There's no excuse not to find you out there. So since this is a little unusual that we have five of us at one time, I'll just have Stacy and then Bonnie and myself kind of give a closing comment to John and Sam for being with us tonight.
Yeah, I'll start. John and Sam, thank you so much for being so open and vulnerable. David, Bonnie, and I have found that with other podcasts where people are sharing, it really does help other people not feel alone. So thank you so much for that.
You bet. Well,
thank you.
I want to thank you both as well. It's wonderful and humbling for us to meet other people that are doing the same path that we're doing. You know, we feel we have very similar missions here. And I'm just so grateful that you could share everything you did with us and our viewers and our guests. Thank you.
And to both of you, I'd like to say that, you know, you are doing powerful work and taking the, you know, the trauma that we've all experienced collectively and individually at 9/11 and through course of doing our jobs and course of living life on this earth. And you've taken it and flipped the script now and are doing it to heal our brothers and sisters. So, deep amount of respect. I'm humbled to you know, be here to listen to you share your story tonight. And thank you so much for being with us and being our guests.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for what you guys do. We're one big family.
Appreciate it.
We invite you to like and subscribe on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, and take care.